All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 43 in this Ancient History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. Yesterday was 42. I said 43, but it was 42. So today is 43. We're continuing with the story of Sparta, and in order to understand this very peculiar form of government that the Spartans had, we need to be able to think in terms of basic categories. And so it's really critical that we have, for the four forms of government that we have previously studied, really nicely automatized and at our disposal as a context of thinking. So let's go through them really quickly here, one by one. And I want you to strive to give me the most essentialized definition you can. And I'm going to put everybody on the spot here. So, Sophie, start us off with monarchy, please.
Rule of one.
There we go. That's it. That's what I want. Okay? Short and sweet. That's the kind that we need for aristocracy as well. Kenny?
Rule the best.
Okay, good. So let's say, just because that is, that's a short and sweet answer, which is great. What I would say is, to give it a little bit of substance, I would say the rule of a group which thinks of itself as the best. Okay? I think that it gives it just a little bit of that substance that we need, because what about maybe one person who thinks he's the best? Well, that's monarchy, right? So, I don't know, just to give it just that little clarification. The rule of a group that thinks of itself as the best. Okay, and now let's do a tyrannos, Juliet.
It's the rule of one elected by the people.
Okay, the rule of one, let's say chosen by, because there's nothing so formal as an election process, right? It's just by acclamation, typically, or some other type of process where this charismatic character ends up on top, right? So the rule of one chosen by the people. Okay, good. And then finally, of course, democracy, Rosie.
Well, democracy means that the majority rules.
Okay, the majority rules. So that, again, is the good and short answer. I think that, just like aristocracy, it's a good idea to just have a slight elaboration on there. So what I would say with democracy is, the best way to do that one is, the rule of the people, because we got demos, the people, which means majority rule. Okay, see how that works again? Just giving us that those little thick components we need to make sure we have that clear understanding. Okay? And so, and another thing about having a definition like that, which means the rule of the people, right? Or government by the people, of the people, for the people, right? That's the kind of stuff that the news is full of sound bites like that, right? And the culture is permeated with those kinds of vague ideas. If you can at least incorporate that in your personal definition, then you're ready to think in a really important historical way. You're ready to take that, which is a vague and in some senses false definition, and then take it and shift the energy of that definition towards the truth. And especially if you're having discussions with somebody concerning democracy, then you say to them, well, yeah, the rule of the people, right? Which, of course, so then what you get to do is, in terms of rhetoric, then what you get to do is you say, which of course means majority rule. And that can help you if you're having discussions with somebody, because if you try to assert a really strict definition from the start of anything, really, you'll find this as a truth in life. If you have the right definition, but most people don't, then, and if you come at them with an aggressive statement of the truth, okay, what you will find is that they will not appreciate that. This is just a rule in life that you will find that when you tell people the truth, which they don't care for, they won't appreciate it. So it's kind of an interesting thing with regard to democracy, which has become this kind of unconscious term in society today. By which I mean people use it, but they aren't thinking. Right? They just use it. They just spit it out, and it ends up all over the place. And this, democratic this, democracy that, and it's out there, but it's an unconscious kind of a usage. How do you help people, if you are an educated, historically minded person, how do you help people get a little bit more clarity about things, perhaps, if you're having open discussions with them when you want to engage people in discussions? So it's always a good idea to try to find that bridge to their context. And so if your definition is the rule of the majority, then people will find that off-putting. They'll say, oh, here's one of those people that thinks they know everything, and the defenses will go up right away and you won't be able to talk to them. But if you say to somebody, yeah, the rule of the people, right? Government of, by, and for the people. And then, oh, it's like you're massaging their brain and they're getting all comfortable. And then you can say, okay, which of course means the majority rules. Oh, and then it's like, oh, you kind of got them to think clearly. You helped them to think clearly by giving them that little extra material so that they can digest it better. Rather than, you know, swallowing the truth whole can give you a mental indigestion sometimes if you're not used to it. So anyway, that's just a thought for anybody here who is, you know, who understands. If you understand the point that you want to have the right definition and that the truth matters and you want to know the truth, all right, if that's your premise, yeah, that's all really good. But of course, then the challenge is knowing the truth. How do you live in society? Which, well, as it turns out, is not always enamored with the truth. So, you know, and this is the question that Socrates had a lot of trouble with, and Galileo and others. And so how do you do it, right? And it is an art. And the Greeks recognized this art. They called it the art of rhetoric. And it was one of the things that you need to develop, a skill that you need to develop in order to function in a social setting where there are controversies, where there are what we call polemics. In other words, arguments and people don't agree with each other and so on. Right. So if you can do that, then you can have potentially really productive discussions about difficult topics. And it's just another one of those things that people don't know how to do today. So, you know, I mean, the big one, the obvious one for me is the whole climate change controversy. That you will not find a clearer example of how poorly people think nowadays than the way that they address this controversy, which is, it's quite fascinating. And so because they don't know how to talk to each other about this, then, you know, on the one hand, you have groups that say, and a lot of people that say, no, it's no issue whatsoever. There isn't even any measurable climate change and so on. And the whole thing is kind of a hoax because, well, who's to say that the climate should stay the same anyways? And they have a whole bunch of really, you know, points that they want to make on that side of the thing. And then on the other hand, there are people who are really, really completely believers of climate change. And then they come back and they say, well, the science is settled. We're not talking about it anymore. And you know, that's usually a sign of a closed mind and a mind that cannot endure any more thinking and doesn't want to put up with any discussion and so on. And again, so how do you kind of try to have a reasonable approach to a topic like that? Good example of another one. We got democracy. Another topic would be climate change. Pretty much anything that you look at in society nowadays where there's controversy, you'll see these issues in terms of how people think and how they talk and discuss. It's important to kind of approach topics for yourself and in order to, you know, get the most out of what's going on, you know, really keep that mind of yours active And especially if you're quite convinced that you've got the truth in a particular topic, then there is an art to how you discuss it. If you really are going to discuss it and not just bash people over the head with the truth, which nobody appreciates. So anyway, that was an interesting offshoot. I didn't think that was going to happen, but it always does. So we got these four forms of government. The rule of one. The rule of one chosen by the people. We have the rule of a group that thinks it's the best. And we have the rule of the people, i.e. the majority. Okay, good. Four really good categories to work with. And now, Sparta. What about Sparta? Very peculiar place. A place where you have kings. And I said kings, plural, right? That's where we left off yesterday with this peculiar thing, which I kind of teased you with. I said, well, I gave you a whole lead up to that. I said, well, there's all kinds of interesting things about Sparta. And we know that it's ruled by a Dorian aristocracy. And then another curious thing about that aristocracy, which we looked at yesterday, was this strange phenomenon of the way in which slaves were held in the society. So just, you guys remember what's the key word there, especially in terms of slave ownership in Sparta, especially differentiated from anywhere else, right? They're very rare examples of slavery occurring in any other form. But what would be the key word? Keen?
Collective ownership.
Collectively. Yeah, right. The slaves were owned collectively. Now, in order to understand that concept, or to kind of wrap your mind around it anyway, it's an invalid concept. It's a contradiction in terms. But it is an idea that has, again, a lot of currency in modern culture. And there is a really good example to kind of think about the idea in the form of so-called public roads, right? So I don't know if you guys have spent any time thinking about other examples, but there are other examples. You could also say public parks. You could also say national parks and that whole kind of category of land usage as well. There are other examples of such thing that are referred to kind of as public property in general. And again, it's a contradiction because property implies or involves as its core, as the essence of the concept, exclusivity. Your property is yours. That's what the concept is for, to designate things that belong to somebody and not anybody else. So your house, your property, or your parents, of course, you don't own one, but your parents' house belongs to them. And that means that some random person off the street doesn't get to walk into your house and sleep in your bed. Right? Your family has exclusive use of that domicile. Nobody else can come into your house and take food out of your fridge and eat it in front of you. That's a home invasion. That is a crime. Right? And you have the right to shoot them if they come in and do that. Or at least call 911. Right? So, you know, this is why we have the concept property. To explain this particular category of facts pertaining to human life. That there are exclusive things that belong to some, to you individually, and not to anybody else. And that it is an absolute moral imperative that in a civilized society, that be respected. Otherwise, we're barbarians. So that's why we need the concept. But then on the other hand, if we have this concept, so-called collective property, well, look at how that works. Okay, you would say, well, everybody gets to use it. That's the essence of it. Okay, but that's not property. That's not ownership. Because everybody is the opposite of exclusive. So yes, everybody can, but no one controls it. So it's okay. So you gotta, it's like juggling some things that don't go together. And it is hard to sort it out. But in the end, the way that that contradiction is resolved is the way that contradictions like that are always resolved, through physical force. So the government controls the public property. So that's, if you want to understand a contradiction like that in public settings, well, all you need to do is look for where the government forces people to do a certain thing, and you will have found it. You will have found how that, you know, whatever that contradiction is not resolved. It is suppressed by means of force. The government controls it. So if the government wants to shut down the road, nothing you can do. You, on the other hand, if you go to a road and close it down, you'll get really quickly what it means that you don't own it. You'll get really quickly what public ownership means. Right? It means that you don't own anything. It means that the government controls it. And so this is how the slaves were owned in Sparta. The Spartans didn't own them. You couldn't say, that's my slave. Those are my slaves. This is my farm. They're working my land. No. What you had there, if you had slaves, was a public resource to which you had no exclusive claim. The government controlled that resource, in essence, and distributed them and did whatever else and disposed of them, the helots, the slaves, and the commoners, essentially, controlled them in every fundamental regard. And so we're talking about a society in which the bulk of the population has no fundamental rights. That's quite something. The people don't have rights. I mean, in Athens, right, you could become a slave in archaic Athens, but only you could forfeit your rights, but only in very special circumstances. But in Sparta, if you were a commoner, you didn't have any rights. Ever. Okay, so what's that? What kind of government is that? Well, like I said, we've got a lot of other things to look at in order to pin this down. And so now we're going to talk a little bit about the two kings idea. An interesting feature of Spartan government. How did Sparta get two kings? Well, we don't really know. There's the honest answer. Let's see here. We have a character called Lycurgus, who, as is discussed here, was the legendary lawgiver of Sparta. Born 800, died 730, which of course should be circa. We don't know the dates. And according to the system of government set out by Sparta, by Lycurgus in the founding period of Sparta, because there were two major tribes that had worked together, there were going to be two kings. So it was kind of a tribal compromise. Didn't have any kind of necessarily really philosophical foundations. It was more of a bargain between the two. In order for them to work together. But nonetheless, it had certain interesting outcomes. So what do you think they were? What would that look like, two kings, as opposed to one? Juliet, go ahead.
No one would have absolute power.
What would have absolute power?
Nobody
would have absolute power. Okay, good point. So neither of the two would have absolute power because there's two of them. Okay, Keen? What else?
I would expect that they might manage different parts of Spartan society because there's an inevitable clash. If you have two monarch-type people, I can easily see serious problems if they were both trying to manage the same thing.
Okay, good anticipation, right? Let's think in terms of advantages and disadvantages, or let's imagine different things that might be the case. So Keen's thought is a good one because what were their responsibilities? In Athens, for instance, there were 9 archons that had different jobs. So when Athens became really an aristocracy, the 9 archons had the power of a king altogether. So, but it was a division of powers. Okay, Theo, go ahead.
Well, I'm thinking that one of the advantages could be, for example, if one of the kings made a mistake, then the other king could notice and fix that mistake before it became a real problem.
Okay, kind of two heads are better than one, kind of in a lot of different ways. Let's talk about that. Let's keep going with that one because it's a good one. Two heads are better than one. In what way? So Theo's thinking in terms of a mistake. That's an interesting take. I hadn't thought of that. But what about something more purposeful? Are two heads better than one? Or two kings better than one? When could you imagine that being the case? Timothy, go ahead.
Well, what if there's some important crisis or something, and then one king has a certain opinion, but then the other king has a different opinion, and thus it's not just one person's opinion, it's two people's opinion.
Okay, is that good or bad?
That's good.
Okay, but how about this? What if there's a crisis and you need a decision? And they disagree.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, I'm just putting that out there, right? I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just wanting you to entertain kind of all the dimensions of the problem because there's a lot of dimensions to it. Now, you can imagine the Spartans weren't dumb, so they would have thought these things through. But I just want you to do the kind of thinking that Lycurgus would have done, right? To say, okay, what's good about having two? Let's organize it in a certain way. Right, so I'll give you an example. For instance, one of the things that were laid out in the laws of Sparta was that one of the kings was the war king, and so there was a division of powers in that regard. So if there was a war, one of them went only. Now you could see how that would be an advantage, couldn't you? Abby, what do you think?
Well, if one of them went to war and perished, then it would still be one king.
Uh-huh. That's what I like. That's what I was thinking too, right? Call it a spare king. Hey, it's nice to have a spare, right? Because when you're on the highway and you get a flat, and you can just replace that tire and keep going. So if you're at war and you lose your king, well, you still got one back home, so that's good, right? And not only that, right, things back home are still orderly because no matter what happens in the field, there's still a king. So you've got that kind of covered, right? Kind of nice, as opposed to perhaps if the king is away, then maybe there's a bunch of mischief going on back home because, you know, the ruler's not there making sure that everything's going the right way. So perhaps somebody's rebelling or getting away with some mischief. But, you know, if you got two kings, you got more coverage. Okay. So, yeah, all of those are good thoughts, useful thoughts, right? And that's a part of the idea of this type of system, which, by the way, does anybody know the name of that? What's the idea of... It is a peculiar type of government. And in truth, I would not opt to call Sparta's government this, but as a category, if you want to have fun with it, it would be called duarchy. So let me type that in for you. Duarchy. the rule of two as opposed to the rule of one, right? That's not too hard. So now we've added another category to your concepts of government. Rule of one, monarchy. Rule of two, duarchy. And of course, you could have fun with it by expanding the number of participants pretty much infinitely. But of course, at a certain point, you just reach aristocracy, so you don't have too many more. Although you might be excited to learn that we will see triarchies in ancient history. So, anyway, let's stick with duarchy for the moment and some of its peculiarities. And so, let's see, the two kings, what about them? So, yeah, typically the way that it worked was they had to agree. Now, tell me about good things about that. How about adopting a rights-respecting perspective here? Let's say you're one of the founding fathers and you're looking back at Sparta and you're saying, hey, did the Spartans come up with anything good? And you would look at duarchy. Would you think that's good? Or let's, you know, relatively speaking, what would you say about that? If you want to design a government that is rights respecting, better or worse than monarchy? Why?
I think it would be, it's better because at least there's some chance of there being a check if one king, you know, loses it or just decides, you know, to enact some sweeping tyrannical, you know, legislation. I mean, you can't really even call it that, but you know, at least there's going to be some possibility that the other king is going to check him and say, you know, no, we're not going to do that.
Yeah, exactly. So use the word check, which is a really good one. It's an American expression, checks and balances, right? So we call that also the separation of powers. Okay, so we're taking the power that would be concentrated in one person and we're distributing it to two people. So that's going to set up, like you said, a set of checks and balances, hopefully, right? If you're organizing that properly, at least, again, from the perspective, even if you don't understand what rights are, and certainly the Spartans didn't, but at least if you understand the concept of oppression, right? And you understand that a ruler can be unjust in that the people can suffer if he adopts some kind of policy which is really detrimental to life in the state. So then, knowing that and knowing that you don't want one person to be able to do that, then a duarchy is true. Hey, that's a nice one. Just put that there. Put two kings there. And the other guy will stop him. Or at least it gives you a better chance, doesn't it? That you won't have that those oppressive measures get into place because the other guy will balance out the authority of the one, and hopefully they won't both be corrupted in the same way at the same time, and you get a nice kind of orderly system there that's more rights respecting, to use modern terms. So yeah, that was an aspect of it, but actually the founding fathers admired Sparta more because it went beyond two kings. The checks and balances in the Spartan system included five other officials. They were called ephors. The ephors were a peculiar kind of agent within the government whose job it was, well, they had their job description was various. But, let's see. So fundamentally, the job of the ephors was to enforce the laws of Sparta. Now that should just, hands should be going up all over the place here, right? When you hear something like that. The job of the ephors was to enforce the laws of Sparta. Okay? Where are the alarm bells going off here? Theo?
Well, that, I mean, it kind of, it just sounds like, sort of like police officers, except since it's Sparta, you know, if they don't like what someone's doing, they'll just chop their head off.
Yeah, okay, but who? Keen?
Well, who makes the laws? I mean...
Oh, okay. What laws? We're talking about the laws. Now, when I say the laws, aren't you guys starting to think in certain terms, right? I mean, if there's a set of laws and there's officers to enforce the laws, those officers are not the same as the king. Wow, like I said, alarm bells here. What's starting to, what interesting category are we converging on here? Not enough of a hint, huh? All right, let me spur you to this a little further here, right? What kind of government is it when you have a king, but also a set of laws? And, of course, especially we're talking about a government in which the laws are fundamental. And the kings, both of them in this case, but or a single king, have to follow the law. What's that called? Juliet.
It's like a constitution. The British had it with Magna Carta.
Okay, louder please.
The British made one like this called the Magna Carta.
Okay, the Magna Carta was the charter that limited the authority of the British king. That's right. King John was forced to sign it in 1215. Okay, and the term is constitutional monarchy. Right. Now that is a very interesting concept. One of the more progressive concepts you will ever find in history. But is that what Sparta was? You should know by now that it's never going to be that easy. So, but let's talk about that a little bit, just to get ourselves, you know, thinking in those terms as well, because it should be obvious by now that Sparta was peculiar, right? It Sparta was one of a kind. So, if we're going to have a concept for it, it's going to be a tricky one. It's going to have to be quite a delimited term, really, that refers to a singular thing in history. But it's such a prominent and such an unusual thing that it kind of just stands out and requires that you name it in its own way. So that is going to be essentially where we end up at a strange particular outcome that has a lot of, you know, attributes, mixed attributes. And one of them is the separation of powers between the kings, the two kings, and the kings and the ephors. So the way that it worked to become a king and to become an ephor, you had to swear an oath of loyalty to each other and to the laws. That, Juliet, you might remember that was similar to what happened at the Magna Carta. Actually, William the Conqueror had all of his barons swear a direct oath of loyalty to him, which was one of the interesting things about English feudalism that was different from France. It wasn't hierarchical, it was flat. So all of the barons had to swear oath of loyalty to the king directly. And so this is kind of a web of loyalties here, where the ephors and the kings swear loyalty to each other and to the laws. So we do have the idea that the king is not above the law, and we have the idea that the ephors are not above the law, and that they're all watching each other. Now, an ephor is not a king, though. So an ephor has, in some sense, less power, but you'd be quite surprised to learn, in some sense, more power. So an E4 was supposed to make sure his primary job was to make sure that the kings followed the law. That's job number one if you're an E4, to make sure that the kings followed the law. Job number two is to make sure the people follow the king. So they're always looking both ways. They're looking at the kings to make sure they're following the law, and they're looking at the people and they're saying, as long as the king does what the law says, then you don't have a choice. You go along with it, and it's my job to make sure that you do. And so, by the way, the E4s had the power of life and death. This is one of the most dramatic aspects of the Spartan government, was that if an E4 judged a Spartiate to be a threat to the state, he could take his life. So if you were, in any sense, a rebellious, troublemaking, whatever, Spartiatai, we're talking about a member of the aristocracy here, supposedly, but you are judged to be a problem, then the E4s could kill you. And that was legal. So, the upshot of this is a profound truth about Sparta, which has got to be one that we're going to factor in to our ultimate determination, right? Because in a system of aristocracy, those aristocrats have that special status, a status that is reserved for them, and they are they're made men, to use a mafia term, right? If you guys ever watch mafia movies, a made man is an untouchable, right? Somebody that you're not allowed to kill. And that is very much like an archaic clan-based type of aristocracy, if it does even exist anymore. And so, you know, crime families run the same way as aristocracies used to run. But here we have, in Spartan aristocracy, there's no such thing as a made man. In fact, even the Spartiatai have no right to life. No fundamental right to life. That's huge right there. This is very different, as you can see from Athens, because in Athens, throughout the entire progression, there's a baseline concept that even the commoners have a rights. They don't use the term, but the point is there's a fundamental respect for the individual human being, and there are instances in the archaic society where that human being can forfeit their rights, but basically you are a citizen, and with that comes a fundamental set of rights. But in Sparta, you would think that because the Spartans are the citizens, Perikoi and the Helots are not, right? They are conquered peoples. They are disposable. They've got little privileges that you grant them as the subordinates in the society. But what about the Spartans? Wouldn't you think, well, these guys have conquered everybody. Don't they deserve to walk around and feel like, hey, we're the boss, right? We're the bosses, so we get certain basic rights, don't we? And again, they didn't have that word. But wouldn't that be the expectation? Wouldn't you think that that would be... You know, why be an aristocrat? Let's put it that way. Why be an aristocrat? Why, what does it get you? Why be a Spartan? I mean, why would you want to be, right? I mean, what would be the point of being on top of this society, Theo?
Well, it means that I would like to be a Spartan type because, despite the fact that the E-Force could kill me, just random people walking on the streets could not chop my head off.
Okay, so that's something, isn't it? Right? So you can still feel pretty comfortable that not everybody can chop your head off. Just the E-Force can chop your head off. Okay. So yeah, that's something, I guess, right? Okay. Abby, what about you?
I would not say that I would want to be a Spartan, because I mean that's got to feel pretty horrible, not having a right to life. But I'd rather be a Spartan than a commoner.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I mean, it's a, kind of like the lesser of two evils situation, right? I mean, you don't have any rights, but you are nonetheless a member of the aristocracy. Of course, the question is, what's that aristocracy worth? Right? I mean, what did you get by conquering those other people? Well, yeah, okay, you get what? You get what? Collective ownership of slaves? Yeah, well, we already know that doesn't, you know, really... That's not like private ownership of slaves. I mean, if you're a person in archaic times, you know, having slaves is normal, so it doesn't bother you, and you're not... You're not. You don't want to be completely, dismissive of the value of slaves. They are a value to you. They are laborers, and so you care for them. And there's a certain relationship you have. They are your slaves, though, and they're your property, and they're a value. And so this is, you know, an archaic way of life. In modern times, we turn away from that. And we get upset, right? But anyway, thinking in Spartan terms, we'd be all right with that, or in archaic terms, right? But the Spartans don't even have that. They don't get the benefit of that individually owning anything. So there's no ownership. Well, I mean, in what sense is there ownership of anything? Then becomes the question. If you don't, because ownership, property, as a concept, depends on a fundamental concept. You can't have the notion of the right to property unless you have a right to life. The right to property is a corollary of the right to life. It means the right to possess the material means of sustaining your life, which of course you need because life is a material process. So it's the right to grow your own food and keep it, and the right to do the kind of work that will allow you to have money and buy the products that you need and create a shelter and to keep that shelter and so on, right? That's your right to life translates into your right to property. They are one and the same. Their kind of right to property is a dimension of the right to life. But the Spartans didn't have a right to life. At least not so far as we've seen in the way that this is, you know, the way that I presented it to you. And as you know, you're probably perhaps a little bit guarded here and thinking, well, Mr. Powell's been doing this thing where he gives us one more piece at a time. And so you're waiting for the next piece, of course. Fair enough. Theo, go ahead.
I'm just thinking, like, it makes sense that you need the right to life in order to have the right to property. Because it won't really do you good to own 19 cows if you're dead.
Well, yeah, exactly, right? I mean, what is property for? It is to sustain life. Very simple, right? So, yeah, it is not a difficult proposition to grasp. And when we're talking about good, we're talking about good for what? Good for sustaining life. So yeah, they're obviously related. But anyway, I'm just laying out this interesting dilemma here about the Spartan system, because it was a society, and I'm going to leave you with this point, and then we'll come back to it, and you're going to have to accept that it's going to be a puzzle that you won't have the answer to all the way until next year, because tomorrow is History Through Art, and Thursday is the writing class, and then it's the Christmas break. So, sorry to keep you in suspense like that, but it's what it is. So anyway, but we have this very peculiar society. Now, isn't it curious? Why would there be two kings if the society doesn't even really have, and why ephors if the society doesn't even really have the premise built into it of the right to life? Why bother? Now, there's an interesting one. Right? Because I keep prodding you guys with questions and saying, well, from a rights perspective, wouldn't this be a good thing? And then we can bounce it back and forth. And okay, but the Spartans didn't have a rights perspective. So what's the point? Then the question you have to ask yourself is, well, what perspective did they have? What were they thinking? Right? What was this Lycurgus character thinking? Here, final image for today. Interesting image of Lycurgus, which will give you some idea. Just a tempting little idea. That's a small one. Is this one bigger? No, that's better. There he is, Lycurgus. I like this portrait. Yeah, and Theo sees that there's a constitution there. But if we're going to do a little quick art appreciation exercise, what do you think was a fundamental consideration in the thinking of Lycurgus? This is a portrait, and so it doesn't contain anything other than the one thing you need. Juliet?
How to be a strong military power.
Right? Shield, sword, spear, helmet, and the laws. Yeah. All right. We'll come back to that. The fascinating idea of Spartan government. We'll explore the premises that underlie it. We'll look a little bit at more of some of the particular features of it. Some of them, I would say, admirable and interesting. Others, profoundly disturbing. And then we have to see, can we add it all up? Okay, folks. Fun so far. So, anyway, tomorrow's History Through Art. So we'll go back to that great painting. And then on Thursday, we have our paragraph. By a quick show of hands, please. Who has submitted their paragraphs? So I see a majority of people have submitted their paragraphs, and maybe some people are forgetting to raise their hand. Okay, but if you haven't yet, got a couple more days maximum there. Please keep going. Okay, keep working on it. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.